I'm Bill Moyers. Welcome to The Journal, on air and online. We'll be here every week beginning this Friday, April 27th, on most stations. Jon Stewart of The Daily Show joins me this week to talk about how faking the news can reveal more of the truth than all the Sunday morning talk shows put together. But tonight, we bring you this special edition of The Journal called Buying the War. 4 years ago this spring, the Bush administration took leave of reality and plunged our country into a war so poorly planned it soon turned into a disaster. The story of how high officials misled the country has been told, but they couldn't have done it on their own. They needed a compliant press to pass on their propaganda as news and cheer them on. Since then, thousands of people have died, and many are dying to this day. Yet the story of how the media bought what the White House was selling has not been told in depth on television. So as the war rages into its fifth year, we look back at those months leading up to the invasion when our press largely surrendered its independence and skepticism to join with our government in marching to war. Our report was produced and directed by Kathleen Hughes and edited by Allison Amron.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening. I'm pleased to take your questions tonight.
2 weeks before he will order America to war, President Bush calls a press conference to make the case for disarming Saddam Hussein.
Iraq is a part of the war on terror. It's a country that trains terrorists, a country that can arm terrorists. Saddam Hussein and his weapons are a direct threat to this country.
For months now, his administration has been determined to link Iraq to 9/11.
September the 11th, should say to the American people that we're now a battlefield.
At least a dozen times during this press conference, he will invoke 9/11 and Al-Qaeda to justify a preemptive attack on a country that has not attacked America.
Mr. President, if you decide...
But the White House press corps will ask no hard questions tonight about those claims. Listen to what the president says.
This is a scripted...
Thank you, Mr. President.
Scripted. Sure enough, the president's staff has given him a list of reporters to call on.
Let's see here. Elizabeth. Gregory. April. Did you have a question or did I call upon you cold?
I have a question.
Okay. I'm sure you do have a question.
He sort of giggled and laughed, and the reporters sort of laughed. I don't know if it was out of embarrassment for him or embarrassment for them, because they still continued to play along. After his question was done, they all shot up their hands and pretended they had a chance of being called on.
Mr. President, how is your faith guiding you?
My faith sustains me because I pray daily. I pray for guidance.
And I think it just crystallized what was wrong with the press coverage during the run-up to war. I think they felt like the war was going to happen, and the best thing for them to do was to get out of the way.
Thank you for your questions. Good night.
Our story begins with the horror of 9/11.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
Like everyone else, journalists were stunned by the death and devastation.
This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
And there, as you can see, perhaps the second tower, the front tower, the top portion of which is collapsing. Good Lord.
If there is a war, it's a war against terrorism that started, rather ongoing right now. It started here at about 8:45 this morning.
There are no words that can describe this. I was deeply moved by 9/11. I don't know of any American who wasn't. I think we all bought into that the world had changed.
I think the atmosphere in the United States after September 11 was so overwhelmingly patriotic and overwhelmingly, we must do something about this.
And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Yeah!
George Bush is the president. He makes the decisions. And, you know, it's just one American. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where.
I didn't mean it in a journalistic sense. I know it may have come across that way. I meant it in a sense as an individual citizen. Mr. President, if you need me, if you need me to go to hell and back for my country, I will do it.
But I'll tell you this. If they could go down to ground zero here in lower Manhattan, and you referred to it earlier, and see the following. See those firemen? Take it for a minute, will you?
Okay, I'll tell you what.
Well, I can finish.
No, Dan, take care of yourself. We'll be right back here with Dan Rather.
What I was wrestling with that night, listening to you, is once we let our emotions out as journalists on the air, once we say we'll line up with the president, can we ever really say to the country the president's out of line?
Yes. Of course you can. Of course you can. No journalist should try to be a robot and say, they've attacked my country, they've killed thousands of people, but I don't feel it. What you can do, and what should have been done in the wake of that, is suck it up and say, okay, that's the way I feel. That's the way I feel as a citizen. And I can serve my country best by being the best journalist I can be. That's the way I can be patriotic. By the way, Bill, this is not an excuse. I don't think there is any excuse for, you know, my performance and the performance of the press in general in the roll-up to the war. There were exceptions. There were some people who I think did a better job than others. But overall and in the main, there's no question that we didn't do a good job.
As Americans reacted to the atrocities of a sneak attack, a powerful surge of solidarity swept across the country.
One of the things that seems to be binding all Americans these days, no matter their backgrounds, in the aftermath of this tragedy, is a renewed sense of patriotism.
To see so many reporters just wearing a little American flag on the lapels, to see Tim Russert on Meet the Press with the red, white, and blue ribbons, I think it's a human emotion there.
And as the administration organized to strike back at the terrorists, there was little tolerance for critical scrutiny from journalists.
There was a patriotic fervor, and the administration used it so that if you challenged anything, you were made to feel that there was something wrong with that.
Walter Isaacson was then chairman and chief executive officer of CNN.
And there was even almost a patriotism police, which, you know, they'd be up there on the internet sort of picking anything a Christian Amanpour or somebody else would say as if it were disloyal.
We interviewed a former reporter at CNN who had been there through that period, and this reporter said to us, quote, everybody on staff just sort of knew not to push too hard to do stories critical of the Bush administration.
Especially at right after 9/11, especially when the war in Afghanistan is going on, there was a real sense that you don't get that critical of a government that's leading us in wartime.
When American forces went after the terrorist bases in Afghanistan, network and cable news reported the civilian casualties. The Patriot Police came knocking.
We'd put it on the air, and by nature of a 24-hour TV network, it was replaying over and over again. So you would get phone calls, you would get advertisers, you would get the administration.
You said pressure from advertisers?
Not direct pressure from advertisers, but big people in corporations were calling up and saying, you're being anti-American here.
So Isaacson sent his staff a memo, leaked to the Washington Post. It seems perverse, he said, to focus too much on the casualties or hardship in Afghanistan.
There's a buddy up here.
And he ordered his reporters and anchors to balance the images of civilian devastation with reminders of September 11th.
I felt if we put it into context, we could alleviate the pressure of people saying, don't even show what's happening in Afghanistan.
Newspapers were squeezed, too. This one in Florida told its editors, do not use photos on page 1A showing civilian casualties. Our sister paper has done so and received hundreds and hundreds of threatening emails. And then there was Fox News, whose chief executive, the veteran Republican operative and media strategist Roger Ailes, had privately urged the White House to use the harshest measures possible after 9/11.
So we were caught between this patriotic fervor and a competitor who was using that to their advantage. They were pushing the fact that CNN was too liberal, that we were sort of vaguely anti-American.
Even as American troops were still chasing Osama bin Laden through the mountains of Afghanistan, Washington was moving toward a wider war. Within hours after the attacks on 9/11, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld put Saddam Hussein on the hit list. An aide took notes.
I knew before 9/11 that many of the people who came into the administration were committed to toppling Saddam Hussein and doing it with military force if necessary.
Dan Rather is talking about prominent Washington figures in and outside of government known as neoconservatives. They had long wanted to transform the Middle East, beginning with the removal of Saddam Hussein. The terrorist attacks gave them the chance they wanted, and the media gave them a platform.
Richard Pearl,
next phase, Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely.
One person close to the debate said to me this week that it's no longer a question of if, it's a question of how we go after Saddam Hussein.
In the weeks after 9/11, they seemed to be on every channel, gunning for Hussein.
You're probably the hawkiest of the hawks on this. Why?
Well, I don't know that I'd accept that characterization, but it's probably not too far off. I think that the Baghdad regime is a serious danger to world peace.
Weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein, plus his known contact with terrorists, including al-Qaeda terrorists, is simply a threat too large to continue to tolerate.
Among their leading spokesmen were Richard Pearl and James Woolsey. Both sat on the Defense Policy Board advising Donald Rumsfeld, and they used their inside status to assure the press that overthrowing Hussein would be easy.
We would be seen as liberators in Iraq.
Major newspapers and magazines gave them prime space to make their case, including the possibility that 9/11 had been sponsored, supported, and perhaps even ordered by Saddam Hussein. The president, they said, should take preemptive action.
The biggest mistake we have made, it's our mistake, it's not the mistake of the Arabs, was not finishing off Saddam Hussein in 1991.
No one got more airtime from an armchair than Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard and a media-savvy Republican strategist. In the 1990s, Kristol had organized a campaign for increased military spending and a muscular foreign policy. In 1998, he and his allies wrote President Bill Clinton urging him to remove Saddam Hussein from power. And now, just days after 9/11, with many of their allies serving in the administration, they wrote an open letter to President Bush calling for regime change in Baghdad. Over the coming months, Kristol's Weekly Standard kept up the drumbeat.
What are the consequences if the U.S. does not finish off Saddam Hussein as the second step in the war on terrorism?
It would mean that the president, having declared a global war on terrorism, didn't follow through, didn't take out the most threatening terrorist state in the world.
The editorial page of the Wall Street Journal signed on. And so did high-profile pundits like the New York Times' William Sapphire.
Sapphire, will you wager Ms. Wright right now that Saddam will be out of power by the end of 2002?
Absolutely. I'll see you here a year from now.
If you go after Iraq, you're going to lose a lot of allies, but who cares? Remember.
Charles Krauthammer and other top columnists at the Washington Post also saw the hand of Saddam Hussein in the terrorist attacks. Jim Hoagland implicated Hussein within hours after the suicide bomber struck on 9/11. And the Post George Will fired away on the talk shows.
The administration knows Hussein has vowed revenge. He has anthrax. He loves biological weapons. He has terrorist training camps, including 707, to practice on.
It was proving difficult to distinguish the opinion of the pundits from the policies of the administration. But as the hullabaloo over Saddam grew in Washington, Bob Simon of CBS News 60 Minutes was dumbfounded. He's based in the Middle East.
From overseas, we had a clearer view. I mean, we knew things or suspected things that perhaps the Washington press corps could not suspect. For example, the absurdity of putting up a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda.
Absurdity? The Washington press corps cannot question an absurdity?
Well, maybe the Washington press corps based inside the belt wasn't as aware as those of us who are based in the Middle East and who spend a lot of time in Iraq. I mean, when the Washington press corps travels, it travels with the president or with the secretary of state. And
in a bubble.
Yeah, in a bubble. Whereas we, who'd spent weeks just walking the streets of Baghdad and in other situations in Baghdad, just were scratching our head in ways that perhaps at the Washington Press Corps could not.
Simon was under no illusions about Saddam Hussein. During the first Gulf War, he and his camera crew were arrested by Iraqi forces and brutalized for 40 days before being released.
Look, we're going home, which is the place you go to after a war if you've been as lucky as we've been.
It didn't make sense to Simon that the dictator would trust Islamic terrorists.
Saddam, as most tyrants, was a total control freak. He wanted total control of his regime, total control of the country. And to introduce a wild card like Al-Qaeda in any sense was just something he would not do. So I just didn't believe it for an instant.
And some of the things that were said, many of the things that were said about Iraq, didn't make sense. And that really prompts you to ask, wait a minute, is this true? Does everyone agree that this is true? Does anyone think this is not true?
This is what we're going to do. This is plan A now. Yeah.
John Wolcott wasn't buying the official line either. The bureau chief of Knight Ridder News Service, he and his reporters covered Washington for 32 newspapers spread across the country.
Our readers aren't here in Washington. They aren't up in New York. They aren't the people who send other people's kids to war. They're the people who get sent to war. And we felt an obligation to them to explain why that might happen. We were determined to scrutinize the administration's case for war as closely as we possibly could, and that's what we set out to do.
So as he listened to pundits and officials talking about Saddam Hussein's supposed connections to 9/11, Wolcott was skeptical.
It was not clear to us why anyone was asking questions about Iraq in the wake of an attack that had Al-Qaeda written all over it.
He assigned his two top reporters to investigate the claim. Between them, Warren Strobel and Jonathan Landay had more than 40 years' experience reporting on foreign affairs and national security. They had lots of sources to call on.
We were basically, I think, hearing two different messages from... It was a message, the public message the administration was giving out about Iraq, its WMD, the fact it was an immediate threat, grave threat, gathering threat. But that was so different from what we were hearing from people on the inside, people we had known in many cases for years and trusted.
They went about their reporting the old-fashioned way, with shoe leather, tracking down and meeting with sources deep inside the intelligence community.
When you're talking to the working grunts, you know, uniformed military officers, intelligence professionals, professional diplomats, those people are more likely than not always, of course, but more likely than not to tell you some version of the truth and to be knowledgeable about what they're talking about when it comes to terrorism or the Middle East and things like that.
Strobel learned that within 2 weeks after 9/11, senior intelligence officers were growing concerned that the Bush administration was stretching little bits and pieces of information to connect Saddam Hussein to Al-Qaeda with no hard evidence.
There was a lot of skepticism among our editors because what we were writing was so at odds with what most of the rest of the Washington Press Corps was reporting. And some of our papers, frankly, just didn't run the stories. They have access to the New York Times wire and the Washington Post, wire, and they chose those stories instead.
Within the month, Strobel found out the Pentagon had already dispatched James Woolsey to Europe, looking for any shred of evidence to incriminate Hussein.
He did this, even knowing that the CIA had already analyzed this carefully and found no such links. So the more I thought about that, the more it just didn't seem to make sense.
Knight Ridder's early skepticism was a rarity inside the Beltway bubble.
A decision to go to war, even against an eighth-rate power such as Iraq, is the most serious decision that a government can ever make. And it deserves the most serious kind of scrutiny that we in the media can give it. Is this really necessary? Is it necessary to send our young men and women to go kill somebody else's young men and women?
That meant asking questions about the sources of information the press and government were relying on, including, notably, this man, Ahmed Chalabi. After the first Gulf War, Americans had installed Chalabi as the leader of Iraqi exiles seeking regime change in Baghdad. Now he was all over Washington as the administration's and the neoconservatives' star witness against Saddam.
Hello.
Chalabi's motives were always perfectly clear in this, and understandable. He was an Iraqi. He didn't want his country run by a thug and a murderer, a mass murderer, and a crook. And everything he said had to be looked at in that light and scrutinized in that light. And why anyone would give him a free pass, or anyone else a free pass for that matter, on a matter as important as going to war is beyond me.
Chalabi was a creature of American propaganda to a large degree. It was a American company, the Rendon Group, that working secretly with the CIA, basically created his organization, the Iraqi National Congress, and put Chalabi in charge, basically.
James Bamford is an independent journalist whose specialty is the intelligence world.
From the very beginning, Chalabi was paid a lot of money from the U.S. taxpayers. The CIA paid him originally about $350,000 a month to Chalabi and his organization. The CIA finally caught on in the mid-90s that Chalabi was a con man, basically, and they dropped him.
Chalabi's handlers in Washington were not deterred by that stain on his credibility. He charmed Congress out of millions more dollars for his cause and had the press eating out of his hand.
He made a lot of friends in the media, and he convinced a lot of people that he was legitimate, even though the CIA had dropped him.
When Chalabi made selected Iraqi defectors available to the press, it was a win-win game. The defectors got a platform. Journalists got big scoops.
It was a big effort, in fact, to find people who seemed to have credible evidence about what was going on inside Iraq. Because, in fact, if you could find somebody who was credible talking about a nuclear program in Iraq or chemical weapons, that would be a big story.
And it worked. The New Yorker, USA Today, The Washington Post, The New York Daily News, The New York Times. And on PBS, just 2 months after 9/11, Frontline and The New York Times teamed up for a documentary on the defectors.
Captain Saba Qaddada is a former Army officer who defected from Iraq. He made a crude drawing of what he says is a terrorist training camp on the outskirts of Baghdad.
There were caveats.
And a further caution. These defectors have been brought to Frontline's attention by one group of Iraqi dissidents, the INC, the Iraqi National Congress.
But the caveats couldn't compete with the spectacular tales told by defectors. Before the invasion, the New York Times' Judith Miller would write six prominent stories based on their testimony.
Ahmed Chalabi is a controversial leader of the Iraqi opposition.
And still on the web, a report about the defectors, narrated by Judith Miller and produced by New York Times Television for the NewsHour on PBS.
Well, Judy Miller had been an old friend of Chalabi, did a lot of the stories on Chalabi, was very favorable to Chalabi.
James Bamford found out that in 2001, Chalabi had arranged for Miller to meet in Thailand with a defector from Iraq named Al-Hadari.
So Al-Hadari was in Bangkok. Judy Miller flew there to interview him. The New York Times ran a front-page story, basically confirming everything the administration had been saying about Iraq.
Al-Hadari said he was a Kurd from northern Iraq. He told Miller the Iraqis had hidden chemical and biological weapons, some Miller reported, right under Saddam's presidential sights. The story spread far and wide.
New York Times is just remains immensely influential. People in the TV world read it every morning, and it's amazing how often you'll see a story go from the front page of the day's paper in the morning to the evening newscast at night. People in government, of course, read it, think tanks, and so on.
There were some red flags that the New York Times story threw out immediately, which caught our eyes immediately. The first was the idea that a Kurd, the enemy of Saddam, had been allowed into his most top secret military facilities. I don't think so. That was, for me, the biggest red flag. And there were others, like the idea that Saddam Hussein would put a biological weapons facility under his residence. I mean, would you put a biological weapons lab under your living room? I don't think so.
The first rule of being an intelligence agent or a journalist, and they're really not that different, is you're skeptical of defectors because they have a reason to exaggerate. They want to increase their value to you. They probably want something from you. Doesn't mean they're lying, but You should be now. Journalists are supposed to be skeptical, right? And I'm afraid the New York Times reporter in that case and a lot of other reporters were just not skeptical of what these defectors were saying, nor was the administration.
A former top Iraqi nuclear scientist tells Congress Iraq could build 3 nuclear bombs by 2005.
Well, now another defector, a senior Iraqi intelligence official, tells Vanity Fair in an exclusive interview that Saddam Hussein has trained an elite fighting force in sabotage, urban warfare, hijacking and murder. David Rose wrote the story. He joins us now from London. Thank you for joining us.
In Vanity Fair's David Rose, defectors found another eager beaver for their claims. The glossy magazine, a favorite of media elites, gave him 4 big spreads to tell defector stories. The talk shows lapped it up.
What the defector Al-Khareri, a former brigadier general in the Iraqi intelligence service, told me is that these guys, there are 1,200 in all. They've been trained to hijack trains, buses, ships, and so forth.
As you track their stories, they become ever more fantastic. And they're the same people who are telling these stories till you get to the most fantastic tales of all, which appeared in Vanity Fair magazine.
The last training exercise was to blow up a full-size mock-up of a U.S. destroyer in a lake in central Iraq.
Or jumping into pits of fouled water and having to kill a dog with your bare teeth. I mean, and this was coming from people who were appearing in all of these stories, and sometimes their rank would change.
Mousawi told us that he has verified that this man was an officer in Iraq's ruthless intelligence service, the Mukhabarat.
And you're saying, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. Because in this story, he was a major, but in this story, the guy's a colonel. And in this story, this was his function, but now he says in this story, he was doing something else.
The defector is telling Mousawi that in order to evade the UN inspectors, Saddam Hussein put his biological weapons laboratories in trucks that the defector told us he personally bought from Renault.
Refrigerator trucks,
yeah,
kind of things.
Yeah.
And how many?
7.
Leslie Stahl and CBS retracted their story a year after the invasion, when nearly all the evidence presented by defectors proved to be false. Vanity Fair's David Rose later said high government officials had confirmed his stories. But these were the very officials who had bet on Chalabi as their favorite man of war. To the Knight Ridder team, it all smelled of a con game.
What he did was reasonably clever but fairly obvious, which is he gave the same stuff to some reporters that for one reason or another he felt would simply report it. And then he gave the same stuff to people in the vice president's office and in the secretary of defense's office. And so if the reporter called the Department of Defense or the vice president's office to check, they would have said, oh, I think that's you can go with that. We have that too. So you create the appearance, or Chalabi created the appearance, that there were 2 sources and that the information had been independently confirmed, when in fact there was only 1 source and it hadn't been confirmed by anybody.
And let's not forget how close these people were to this administration, which raises the question, was there coordination? I can't tell you that there was, but it sure looked like it.
The administration was now stepping up efforts to nail down a tangible link between Saddam and 9/11. Journalists were tipped to a meeting that supposedly took place in Prague between Iraqi agents and the 9/11 ringleader, Mohammed Atta. Pundits had a field day.
He has contacts outside in Sudan and Afghanistan with terrorists. They did indeed have a contact between Atta and an Iraqi diplomat.
In the New York Times, William Safire called the Prague meeting an undisputed fact. He would write about the Atta connection 10 times in his op-ed column. Just weeks after 9/11, Safire had predicted a quick war, with the Iraqis cheering their liberators and leading the Arab world toward democracy. Between March 2002 and the invasion a year later, Safire would write a total of 27 opinion pieces fanning the sparks of war.
Senator Joe Biden's
and on Tim Russert's Meet the Press, Safire kept it up.
Bill Safire, the difference between sufficient provocation and a preemptive strike.
I don't think we need any more provocation than we've had by 10 years of breaking his agreement at the ceasefire. He had been building weapons of mass destruction.
In October, his own paper ran a front-page story by James Risen questioning the evidence. Then came this report from Bob Simon.
The administration has been trying to make a link to implicate Saddam Hussein in the attacks of September 11. And they've been pointing to an alleged meeting between Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, and an Iraqi intelligence officer in the Czech capital of Prague.
If we had combed Prague and found out that there was absolutely no evidence for a meeting between Mohammed Atta and an Iraqi intelligence figure, if we knew that, we had to figure that the administration knew it. And yet they were selling the connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam.
Bob Baer spent 16 years as an undercover agent for the CIA in the Middle East.
How did you get to Bob Baer, the former CIA official who was such an important source for you?
we called him.
How did you find him? Did you know him?
I knew some friends of his. It wasn't a problem getting his phone number. Any reporter could get his phone number.
Who was he? Why was he important?
He was one of the guys who was sent to Prague to find that link. He was sent to find the link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam.
He would have been a hero if he'd found the link.
Oh, my heavens, yes. I mean, this was what everyone was looking for.
But there was little appetite inside the networks for taking on a popular wartime president. So Simon decided to wrap his story inside a more benign account of how the White House was marketing the war.
It's not the first time a president has mounted a sales campaign to sell a war.
And I think we all felt from the beginning that to deal with a subject as explosive as this, we should keep it in a way almost light, if that doesn't seem ridiculous.
Going to war almost light.
Not to present it as a frontal attack on the administration's claims, which would have been not only premature, but we didn't have the ammunition to do it at the time. We did not know then that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We only knew that the connection the administration was making between Saddam and Al-Qaeda was very tenuous at best, and that the argument it was making over the aluminum tubes seemed highly dubious. We knew these things, and therefore we could present the Madison Avenue campaign on these things, which was a sort of softer, less confrontational way of doing it.
Did you go to any of the brass at CBS, even at 60 Minutes, and say, look, we got to dig deeper. We got to connect the dots. This isn't right.
No, in all honesty, with 1,000 mea culpas, I've done a few stories in Iraq, but no, I don't think we followed up on this.
Iraq is in possession of weapons of mass destruction, contrary to their promises.
What the White House was now marketing as fact would go virtually unchallenged.
We know they have weapons of mass destruction. We know they have active programs.
As the Washington Post veteran reporter Walter Pincus would later report, the propaganda machine was run by the president's inner circle, officials who call themselves the White House Iraq Group, or WHIG.
You wrote that WHIG included Karl Rove, the Chief of Staff Andrew Card, Mary Maitland, Condi Rice, Stephen Hadley, Louis Libby, and they were in charge of selling the war.
Selling the war, yeah.
Good evening. A long year has passed since enemies attacked our country.
Their chief salesman had the best props at his disposal.
And we will not allow any terrorist or tyrant to threaten civilization with weapons of mass murder.
They were created in that link.
The marketing group.
The marketing group. And the link was a twofold link. One, he had weapons of mass destruction. And two, he supported terrorists. And they repeated it every day. Anybody who watches television these days know you sell a product, not just by saying it once, by saying it over and over again with new spokesmen 2-3 times a day, and it sinks into the public.
Is there anything unusual about an administration marketing its policy?
I think each administration has learned from the other, and that this group is just the cleverest I've ever seen, and took it to new heights.
The TV, radio, print, other media outlets are as crucial to going to war as the bombs and the bullets and the planes. They're part of the arsenal, the propaganda weaponry, if you will. And that's totally understood across the board at the Pentagon, the White House, the State Department.
The proven menace like Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction.
The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We do have solid evidence of the presence in Iraq of Al-Qaeda members.
The regime has long-standing and continuing ties to terrorist organizations.
Just repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Repeat Al-Qaeda Iraq, Al-Qaeda Iraq, Al-Qaeda Iraq. Just keep it going. Keep that drumbeat going. And it was effective because long after, it was well established that there was no link between Al-Qaeda and the government of Iraq and the Saddam regime. The polls showed that an overwhelming majority of Americans believed that Al-Qaeda, that Iraq, was responsible for September 11th.
Most people actually believed and accepted that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I have to admit that until we really started burrowing into this story, that I believed it too.
I mean, is this something that they could go along?
And they found plenty of evidence to contradict the official propaganda, and the facts quickly changed his mind.
I simply spent basically a month familiarizing myself with what Saddam's weapons of mass destruction programs had been and what had happened to them. And there was tons of material available on that from the UN weapons inspectors. I mean, they got into virtually everything. And their reports were online.
If you go down here, the Iraq Nuclear Verification Office, they put up regular, here you go, the key findings, what they found out about Iraq's nuclear weapons program. It's all here in the open for anybody who wants to read it.
International inspectors had gone into Iraq after the first Gulf War to search for and to destroy Saddam Hussein's weapon systems. Late in 1998, the inspections came to an abrupt halt after the Iraqi government refused to cooperate. But that hardly meant no one was watching.
During the period of time between when the inspectors left Iraq, which was in 1998, at the end of 1998, and then, the United States had covered the place with spy satellites and U-2 overflights, and you know, the other intelligence services had their eyeballs on this place. There's a great
danger that That's why Lande was surprised by what Vice President Cheney told a group of veterans in late August 2002.
Many of us are convinced that Saddam Hussein will acquire nuclear weapons fairly soon.
And I looked at that and I said, what is he talking about? Because to develop a nuclear weapon, you need specific infrastructure. And in particular, the way the Iraqis were trying to produce a nuclear weapon was through enrichment of uranium. Now, you need tens of thousands of machines called centrifuges to produce highly enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon. You've got to house those in a fairly big place, and you've got to provide a huge amount of power to this facility. Could he really have done it with all of these eyes on his country?
But we now know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons.
So when Cheney said that, I got on the phone to people, and one person said to me, somebody who watched proliferation as their job, said the vice president is lying.
On the basis of his intelligence sources, Lande wrote there was little evidence to back up the vice president's claims. But the story Lande wrote didn't run in New York or Washington. Knight Ritter, remember, has no outlet in either city. So it couldn't compete with a blockbuster that appeared 2 days later on the front page of the nation's paper of record with the familiar byline. Quoting anonymous administration officials, the Times reported that Saddam Hussein had launched a worldwide hunt for materials to make an atomic bomb using specially designed aluminum tubes. And there, on Meet the Press that same morning, was Vice President Cheney.
Tubes. There's a story in the New York Times this morning. I want to attribute to the Times. I don't want to talk about, obviously, specific intelligence sources. But
now, ordinarily, information like the aluminum tubes wouldn't appear in it. It was top secret intelligence, and the Vice President and the National Security Advisor would not be allowed to talk about this on the Sunday talk shows. But it appeared that morning in the New York Times, and therefore they were able to talk about it.
It's now public that, in fact, he has been seeking to acquire, and we have been able to intercept and prevent him from acquiring through this particular channel, the kinds of tubes that are necessary to build a centrifuge. And the centrifuge is required to take low-grade uranium and enhance it into highly enriched uranium, which is what you have in order to build a bomb.
Did you see that performance?
I did.
What did you think?
I thought it's remarkable.
Why?
Remarkable. You leak a story and then you quote the story? I mean, that's a remarkable thing to do.
And that's only part of it. Using the identical language of the anonymous sources quoted in the Times, top officials were now invoking the ultimate specter of nuclear war, the smoking gun, as mushroom cloud.
There will always be some uncertainty about how quickly he can acquire a nuclear weapon, but we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
Those sorts of stories, when they appear on the front page of the so-called liberal New York Times, it absolutely comes with a stamp of approval. I mean, if the New York Times thinks Saddam is on the precipice of some of these mushroom clouds, then there's really no debate.
We read in the New York Times today a story that says that Saddam Hussein is closer to acquiring nuclear weapons. Does he have nuclear weapons? Is there a smoking gun here?
Smoking gun is an interesting phrase.
And as we saw in reporting just this morning,
what specifically has he obtained that you believe would enhance his nuclear development program?
Was it just a coincidence in your mind that Cheney came on your show and others went on the other Sunday shows the very morning that that story appeared?
I don't know. The New York Times is a better judge of that than I am.
No one tipped you that it was going to happen?
No.
Cheney office didn't make any, didn't leak to you that there's going to be a big story?
No. I mean, I don't have a, this is, you know, on Meet the Press, people come on and there are no ground rules. We can ask any question we want. I did not know about the aluminum tube story until I read it in the New York Times.
Critics point to September 8, 2002, and to your show in particular, as the classic case of how the press and the government became inseparable. Someone in the administration plants a dramatic story in the New York Times, and then the vice president comes on your show and points to the New York Times. And it's a circular, self-confirming leak.
I don't know how Judith Miller and Michael Gordon reported that story, who their sources were. It was a front-page story of the New York Times. When Secretary Rice and Vice President Cheney and others came out that Sunday morning on all the Sunday shows, they did exactly that. What my concern was is that there were concerns expressed by other government officials. And to this day, I wish my phone had rung or I had access to them.
Bob Simon didn't wait for the phone to ring. But when you said a moment ago when we started talking to people who knew about aluminum tubes, what people? Who were you talking to?
We were talking to people, to scientists and to researchers and to people who had been investigating Iraq from the start.
Would these people have been available to any reporter who called, or were they exclusive sources for 60 Minutes?
No, I think that many of them would have been available to any reporter who called.
And you just picked up the phone?
Just picked up the phone.
Talked to them?
Talked to them and then went down with the cameras.
Few journalists followed suit. And throughout the fall of 2002, high officials were repeating apocalyptic warnings with virtually no demand from the establishment press for evidence.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Could members of the press have known at that point that the administration was exaggerating?
Individuals did it. There were specialists who were raising questions. And one of our reporters, Joby Warwick, wrote a very tough piece about not just the disagreement, but how doubtful it was that these tubes were for nuclear weapons. It was a one-day piece in our paper, and it wasn't picked up.
But Warwick's story appeared on page 18, not page 1.
The front page of the Washington Post, or any newspaper, is a billboard of what the editors are telling you. These are the most important stories of the day. And stories that don't run on the front page, the reader sort of gets that, well, these are of secondary importance.
Howard Kurtz is the Washington Post media critic.
I went back and did the math. From August 2002 until the war was launched in March of 2003, there were about 140 front page pieces in the Washington Post making the administration's case for war. It was the president said yesterday, the vice president said yesterday, the Pentagon said yesterday. Well, that's part of our job. Those people want to speak. We have to provide them a platform. I don't have anything wrong with that. But there was only a handful of stories that ran on the front page, some more that ran inside the pages of the paper, that made the opposite case, or if not making the opposite case, raised questions. Was this really true? What was the level of proof? Did the CIA really know? What were those aluminum tubes? Those stories, and some reporters worked hard on them, had a harder time getting on the front page. Why? Because they weren't definitive.
But who defines definitive? Reporter Walter Pickus' sources, deep inside the government, questioned how the intelligence was being used. But his stories were mostly relegated to the back pages. Across the media world, the bellicose but unconfirmed claims made the big headlines. The cautionary stories did not.
And I believe, honestly, people don't have a fear of irritating the White House, certainly not at the Washington Post. But they do worry about sort of getting out ahead of something.
Isn't that supposed to be scoop journalism?
Well, but you could be wrong.
And it's a truism that individual journalists and, in fact, the top-ranked media outlets they work for really want to be ahead of the curve but not out on a limb. And if you took seriously the warning flags that were profuse before the invasion of Iraq, that the administration's story was a bunch of nonsense about WMDs, you would not just be ahead of the curve a little, you would have been way out on a limb.
I don't think there was enough skepticism because I think most of us kind of believed that Saddam Hussein was building biological, chemical, and perhaps even nuclear weapons.
Isn't it the role of the Fourth Estate, though, to be critical of groupthink?
It definitely is, and I think we in the press were not critical enough. We didn't question our sources enough.
We weren't smart enough. We weren't alert enough. We didn't dig enough. And we shouldn't have been fooled in this way.
Even Oprah got in on the act, featuring in October 2002, New York Times reporter Judith Miller.
The U.S. intelligence community believes that Saddam Hussein has deadly stocks of anthrax, of botulinum toxin, which is one of the most virulent poisons known to man.
Liberal hawk Kenneth Pollack.
And what we know for a fact from a number of defectors who've come out of Iraq over the years is that Saddam Hussein is absolutely determined to acquire nuclear weapons and is building them as fast as he can.
And the right-hand man to Ahmed Chalabi.
And so, do the Iraqi people want the American people to liberate them?
Absolutely. In 1991, Iraqi people...
I hope that doesn't offend you.
When one guest dared to express doubt, Oprah would have none of it.
I just don't know what to believe with the media.
Oh, we're not trying to show you propaganda. We're just showing you what is.
I understand that.
Okay, you have a right to your opinion. You
That's
know
right.
What I mean.
That's right.
Contrary opinions weren't very popular in Washington either, as ambitious Democrats embraced the now conventional but unconfirmed wisdom.
In the wake of September 11th, who among us can say with any certainty to anybody that the weapons might not be used against our troops or against allies in the region?
It is clear, however, that if left unchecked, Saddam Hussein will continue to increase his capacity to wage biological and chemical warfare and will keep trying to develop nuclear weapons.
When Democrats did go against the grain, they were denounced by the partisan press and largely ignored by the mainstream press.
And before we put this great nation on the track to war, I want to see more evidence, hard evidence, not more presidential rhetoric.
I have heard no persuasive evidence that Saddam is on the threshold of acquiring the nuclear weapons he has sought for more than 20 years. And the administration has offered no persuasive evidence that Saddam would transfer chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction to al-Qaeda.
Ted Kennedy gave a passionate speech in 2002 raising all sorts of questions about the war and what the aftermath would be.
War with Iraq before a genuine attempt at inspection and disarmament or without genuine international support could swell the ranks of al-Qaeda that sympathizes and trigger an escalation in terrorist acts.
Washington Post gave that speech one sentence, 36 words. I calculated in 2002, the Washington Post probably published 1,000 articles and columns about Iraq, probably 1 million words, in excess of 1 million words. And when the most famous Democrat in the country raised questions about the war, the Washington Post set aside 36 words.
It had now become unfashionable to dissent from the official line, unfashionable and risky.
Anyone who hurts this country in a time like this, well, let's just say you will be spotlighted.
If you're a journalist or a politician and you're swimming upstream, so to speak, you're going to encounter a lot of piranha, and they are voracious. There's a notion that this is the person that we go after this week.
Fox News and talk radio and the conservative bloggers, I mean, they were banging those drums very loud, and everyone in the press could hear it. But not only was it just liberal bias, it was an anti-American bias, an unpatriotic bias, and that these journalists were really not part of America.
And every journalist knew it. They had and they have a very effective slime machine. And that the way it works is you either report the news the way we want it reported, or we're going to hang a sign around your neck.
I will call those who publicly criticize their country in a time of military crisis, which this is, bad Americans.
There's a level of vitriol and vindictiveness that is very scary to listen to. And you think the millions of people listening to them, the media have become sort of like the whipping boy because they know that the press can provide information that runs counter to what the government is claiming, to what the Bush administration is claiming.
Now, Donahue.
On his new MSNBC talk show, Phil Donahue discovered just what could happen when you stepped out of line.
City tonight, anti-war protesters taking on the government, is there a place for them in this post-9/11 world, or are they just downright unpatriotic?
I just felt, you know, what would be wrong with having one show a night, you know, say, hold it, wait a minute, can we afford this? And do we have enough troops? And what about General Shinseki? And where are all, you know, what is Guantanamo? What's wrong with this? I felt people who didn't like my message would watch me because no one else was doing it. That's why I couldn't get over the unanimity of opinion on cable. The drum was beating. Everybody wanted to bomb somebody. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. So here I go. I mean, fool that I am. I rushed in.
Scott Ritter is here, and so is Ambassador Butler.
You had Scott Ritter, who former weapons inspector, who was saying that if we invade, it'll be a historic blunder.
Yes, now, but we didn't have Malone. He had to be there with someone else who supported the war. In other words, you couldn't have Scott Ritter alone. You could have Richard Furl alone.
You could have the conservative.
You could have the supporters of the president alone. And they would say why this war is important. You couldn't have a dissenter alone. Our producers were instructed to feature two conservatives for every liberal.
You're kidding.
No, this is absolutely
instructed
true.
From above?
Yes. I was counted as two liberals.
They're underselling
so
you.
I had to have two. There's just a terrible fear. And I think that's the right word.
Eric Sorensen, who was the president of MSNBC, told the New York Times, quote, any misstep and you can get into trouble with these guys and have the patriotism police hunt you down.
Yes. Well, he's the management guy, so his phone would ring. Nobody's going to call Donahue and tell him to shut up and support the war. Nobody's that foolish. It's a lot more subtle than that.
I think that what happened in the months leading up to the war is that there was a sort of acceptable mainstream opinion that got set. And I think that people who were seen as outside that mainstream were viewed as sort of fringe, and they were marginalized. You saw that in the demonstrators.
One, two, three.
How people demonstrating did not get much play.
Five, six, seven, eight. Stop the bombing, stop the hate.
We don't want no Iraq war. Joe Dick Cheney through the door.
So in October of 2002, 100,000 people in Washington One of the largest, you know, peace demonstrations in years in the United States. And the press just, you know, the Washington Post put a photo on its Metro page.
Photographs ran with an article, but the paper's ombudsman later criticized the Post for not giving the story more prominence. Meanwhile, in the 6 months leading up to the invasion, the Washington Post would editorialize in favor of the war at least 27 times. What got even less ink than the protesters was the release of something called the National Intelligence Estimate. Before voting to give the president war powers, Congress asked the administration to detail all the top-secret evidence it was using to justify an invasion. The press got a declassified version. Most of the media gave it a cursory reading, but Jonathan Landay examined the text closely.
I got my copy, and I opened it up.
This is the white paper that they...
And I came to the part that talked about the aluminum tubes. Now, it said that the majority of analysts believed that those tubes were for the nuclear weapons program. It turns out, though, that that majority of intelligence analysts had no background in nuclear weapons.
Knight Ritter was on top of the most important story of the run-up to the invasion, the manipulation of intelligence to make the case for war. On October 4th, Landay wrote, "The White House and the Pentagon are pressuring intelligence analysts to suppress information that might undercut support for the war."
So here was yet another building block in this chain of building blocks that we had collected over these months about what they were saying to the public and what the intelligence was actually telling them. And there were differences. Some of them were nuanced, some of them were quite large. But it became quite apparent that they were grabbing just about anything they could to make the case for going to war in Iraq.
Over a dozen sources told Knight Ritter that the Pentagon was pressuring analysts to cook the intelligence books. Deep throats were talking, but few in the press were listening.
There are people within the U.S. government who object when they perceive that their government isn't being straight with the people, and when they perceive that an administration is veering away from the principles on which this country was built, they are become more ready to talk about things that perhaps they ordinarily shouldn't.
Ayes are 296, the nays are 133, the joint resolution is passed.
Ignoring the reports of flawed intelligence, Congress gave the president the go-ahead for use of force. Knight Ritter's team just kept on digging. By the end of the month, their reporting had come full circle. Sources confirmed that the Pentagon was preparing for war based on information from Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress, despite objections from experts inside the CIA.
The administration can withstand the Knight Ritter critique because it wasn't reverberating inside Washington, and therefore people weren't picking it up.
We were under the radar most of the time at Knight Ritter. We were not a company that I think Karl Rove and others cared deeply about, even though in terms of readers we're much bigger than the New York Times, the Washington Post. We're less influential. There's no way around that.
But there was a period when we were sitting out there, and I had a lot of late-night gut checks where I was just like, are we totally off on some loop here?
Yeah,
are we wrong? Are we
every day
embarrassed?
Every day we'd look at each other and say, really, literally. And one of us would find something out, and I'd look at him and I'd say, what's going on here?
But I think it's telling that they didn't really operate by that Beltway game, the way the networks, the cable channels, Newsweek, Time, New York Times, Washington Post. They seem to sort of operate outside that bubble. And look at what the benefits were when they operated outside that bubble. They actually got the story right. What's important is it's proof positive that that story was there and it could have been gotten, and some people did get it, but the vast majority chose to ignore it or not even try.
How many times did I get invited on a talk show? How many times did you get invited on a talk show?
I think maybe
not the big talk
actually,
shows, not the big Sunday shows.
You know what? Yeah. I'll tell you who invited me on the talk show. C-SPAN.
Television, especially cable television, has a sort of crossfire mentality.
You put on the pro-Bush guest and the anti-Bush guest, and they go at it. You put on the let's go into Iraq, let's not go into Iraq, and they go at it. Well, that's what they do. They're pundits. But that's not a debate that's particularly well-suited to shedding light on whether or not the Bush administration's case for war rested on some kind of factual basis. That's not what pundits do.
I mean, I really think the reason the United States has a bad reputation in the Arab world is that we have been on the side of dictatorships. We've been on the side of very corrupt, very backward governments in places.
Peter Beinart became editor of the New Republic at age 28. During the run-up to the invasion, he was one of the hottest young pundits in town, a liberal hawk, accusing opponents of the war of being intellectually incoherent and echoing the official line that Hussein would soon possess a nuclear weapon.
We need a little bit of logistical support, but we don't need the moral support of anyone because we're on the side of the angels in this.
Had you been to Iraq?
No.
So what made you present yourself, if you did, as a Middle East expert?
I don't think that I presented myself as a Middle East expert, per se. I was a political journalist. I was a columnist writing about all kinds of things. Someone in my position is not a Middle East expert in the way that somebody who studies this at a university is, or even at a think tank. But I consume that stuff. I was relying on people who did that kind of reporting and people who had been in the government, who had access to classified material for their assessment.
And you would talk to them, and they would, in effect, brief you off background on what they knew.
Sometimes
I'm trying to help the audience understand. How does you describe yourself as a reporter of political opinion, or a journalist of political opinion? How do you get the information that enables you to reach the conclusion that you draw as a political journalist?
Well, it was reading. It was reading the statements and the things that people said. I was not a beat reporter. I was editing a magazine and writing a column. So I was not doing a lot of primary reporting, but what I was doing was a lot of reading of other people's reporting and reading of what officials were saying.
If we journalists get it wrong on the facts, what is there to be right about?
Well, I think that's a good point. But the argument in the fall of 2002 was not mostly about the facts. It was about a whole series of ideas about what would happen if we invaded.
What I'm trying to get at is how does the public sort all this out from out there beyond the Beltway? Far more people saw you see Bill Kristol on television than will ever read the Associated Press reports or the Knight Ritter reporters. Isn't there an imbalance then in what the public is going to perceive about a critical issue of life and death like war?
I think it's important for people. Look, would it be better if television were not the primary medium through which people got their news? Yes, that's why I do television, but I'm primarily in the business of writing and editing because I believe ultimately that words can convey more richer information than television. Would we be a better society if people got most of their news from print rather than television? Yes, I think we would.
One of the great pressures we're facing in journalism now is it's a lot cheaper to hire thumbsuckers and pundits and have talk shows on the air than actually have bureaus and reporters. And in the age of the internet, when everybody's a pundit, we're still going to need somebody there to go talk to the colonels, to be on the ground in Baghdad and stuff, and that's very expensive.
Reporting is hard. The substitute for reporting far too often has become, let's just ring up an expert. Let's see, these are experts on international armaments. And I'll just go down the list here and check Richard Perle.
Once it begins to look as though he is relinquishing his grip on power, I think he's toast.
The choice is disarming him by war or letting him have these weapons of mass destruction.
This is journalism on the cheap, if it's journalism at all. Just pick up the phone, call an expert, bring an expert into the studio. Easy. Not time-consuming, doesn't take resources, and if you're lucky and good with your list of people, be an articulate person who will kind of spark up the broadcast.
The people at Knight Ritter were calling the colonels and the lieutenants and the people in the CIA and finding out, you know, that intelligence is not very good. We should have all been doing that.
How do you explain that the further you get away from official Washington, the closer you get to reality?
That's one of the hazards in this business, is when you rely on top-level sources too much, you can lose out on getting the real information.
The president's top national security advisors fanned out on the talk shows with a coordinated message.
The test here is not whether they can find something. The test is whether or not Iraq is going to cooperate.
This is about the disarmament of Iraq, not about weapons inspectors hunting and pecking all over the country.
Time is running out, and we just can't keep hunting and pecking and looking.
The people at the top generally are political rather than professional. And their first loyalty is to a political party or to a person. not to a bureaucracy, not to a job. And so what you get from them is spin.
Look, I'm a blue-collar guy from Buffalo. I know who my sources are. I work them very hard. It's the mid-level people that tell you the truth.
They're the ones who know the story?
Well, they're working on the problem, and they understand the detail much better than a lot of the so-called policymakers and political officials.
But they don't get on the Sunday talk show.
No, you can't. I mean, they don't want to be, trust me. They can lose their jobs, and they know it. But they can provide information which can help in me challenging or trying to draw out sometimes their bosses and other public officials.
What do you make of the fact that of the 414 Iraq stories broadcast on NBC, ABC, and CBS nightly news from September 2002 until February 2003, almost all the stories could be traced back to sources from the White House, the Pentagon, and the State Department?
It's important that you have an opposition party. That's our system of government.
So it's not news unless there's somebody...
No, I didn't say that. But it's important to have an opposition party, your opposing views.
More and more in the media become, I think, common carriers of administration statements and critics of administration. And we've sort of given up being independent on our own.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
We used to do at the Post something called truth squatting. President would make a speech. We used to do it with Ronald Reagan the first 5 or 6 months because he would make so many factual errors, particularly his press conferences.
From $10,000 to $60,000 a year.
And after 2 or 3 weeks of it, the public at large would say, why don't you leave the man alone? He's trying to be honest. He makes mistakes. So what? And we stopped doing it.
You stop being a truth squat.
We stopped truth squatting every sort of press conference or truth squatting. And we left it then to the Democrats. In other words, it's up to the Democrats to catch people, not us.
So if the Democrats challenged a statement from the president, you could quote both sides?
We then quote both sides.
You know, that's called objectivity by many standards, isn't it?
Well, that's objectivity if you think there are only two sides and if you're not interested in the facts. And the facts are separate from, you know, what one side says about the other.
By late November 2002, the press had yet another chance to get the facts right. Facing intense international pressure, the White House agreed to hold off military action until Saddam Hussein permitted a team of UN inspectors to return to Iraq and take a closer look. The first inspections began on November 27th. Charles Hanley, a prize-winning reporter for the Associated Press with more than 30 years' experience reporting on weapons issues, went along to cover their work.
What we did was go out every day with the inspectors. These guys would roar out on these motorcades at very high speed and roar through towns and do sudden U-turns and drive over land and do all of these things to confuse the Iraqis about where they were going so that there wouldn't be a call ahead telling them to put away all the bad stuff. The inspectors then would issue a daily report, and as it turned out, of course, inspection after inspection turned out to be clean. They had nothing to report, no violations to report.
In January of 2003, Hanley wrote about the suspicious sites that the U.S. and British governments had earlier identified as major concerns. No smoking guns in almost 400 inspections, he reported. It ought to have cast serious doubt on the White House's entire evaluation of the Iraqi threat. But reporting like this was overshadowed by the drumbeat from Washington, which is why, Hanley says, sometimes his editors balked when he wrote that the White House lacked firm evidence on weapons of mass destruction.
And that would be stricken from my copy because it would strike some editors as tendentious, as sort of an attack or some sort of allegation rather than a fact. You know, and we don't want our reporters alleging things. You just report the facts. Well, it was a fact. It was a very important fact that seemed to be lost on an awful lot of journalists, unfortunately.
6 weeks before the invasion, with the facts still in short supply, the American Secretary of State went before the United Nations.
I cannot tell you everything that we know, but
What I can share with you, when combined with what all of us have learned over the years, is deeply troubling.
One major problem was that Secretary Powell barely acknowledged that there were inspections going on. It got to ridiculous points, such as his complaining about the fact that they'd put a roof over this open-air shed where they were testing missiles.
This photograph was taken in April of 2002. Since then, the test stand has been finished and a roof has been put over it, so it'll be harder for satellites to see what's going on underneath the test stand.
What he neglected to mention was that the inspectors were underneath watching what was going on.
A single drop of VX on the skin will kill in minutes. 4 tons.
He didn't point out that most of that had already been destroyed. And on point after point, he failed to point out that these facilities about which he was raising such alarm were under repeated inspections by good expert people with very good equipment, and who were leaving behind cameras and other monitoring equipment to keep a continuing eye on it.
Leaving Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction for a few more months or years is not an option, not in a post-September 11th world.
The holes in his presentation became immediate within days, if not hours.
But what I want to bring to your attention today is the potentially much more sinister nexus between Iraq and the al-Qaeda terrorist network, a nexus that combines classic terrorist organizations and modern methods of murder.
One of the first big embarrassments was Powell had talked about this British intelligence report.
I would call my colleagues' attention to the fine paper that the United Kingdom distributed yesterday, which describes in exquisite detail Iraqi deception activities.
Supposedly, that exquisite detail from British intelligence came from a top-secret dossier.
Literally, within a day or two, it was proven in the British press that had simply been downloaded off the internet and was plagiarized, and it can actually contain the typos that were in the original.
The British government dossier is supposed to be about Iraqi deception and concealment. It says it draws upon a number of sources, including intelligence material. Well, actually, what it largely draws on is a thesis written by a Californian postgraduate student.
That was just the first of many embarrassments that were to come. But within days, the British press was going crazy over this revelation.
As for the student himself, he's accused the government of plagiarism.
If the government is reduced to trawling academic journals, then how good is the rest of its case for war against Iraq?
Few prominent American broadcasters would ask such pointed questions.
The Secretary of State Colin Powell has made the case against Iraq.
Secretary of State Colin Powell has given a lot of important speeches in his lifetime to a lot of large audiences, but no speech was more important than the one he gave today.
In the United Nations Security Council this morning, the Secretary of State Colin Powell took almost an hour and a half to make the Bush administration's case against Saddam Hussein.
Making the case for war, Secretary Powell shows the world what he calls undeniable proof.
Colin Powell was trusted, is trusted, I'd put it in a sense. He, unlike many of the people who made the decision to go to war, Colin Powell has seen war. He knows what a green jungle hell Vietnam was. He knows what the battlefield looks like. And when Colin Powell says to you, I, Colin Powell, am putting my personal stamp on this information. It's my name, my face, and I'm putting it out there. That did make a difference.
And you were impressed.
I was impressed. And who wouldn't be?
And you look at the response from, forget about the right-wing media, from the so-called liberal press the next morning. You pick up the Washington Post on the op-ed page. There's Jim Hoagland saying, obviously, from what Powell said, there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You go a few inches away to Richard Cohen, avowed liberal. He says, obviously, there are weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it's a fair paraphrase to say these pundits and many others were asserting, if you don't think there are WMDs in Iraq, you are an idiot.
Across the country, editorial writers bought what Powell was selling. A masterful legal summary. A strong, credible, and persuasive case. A powerful case. An ironclad case. succinct and damning evidence, a detailed and convincing argument, an overwhelming case, a compelling case, a persuasive, detailed accumulation of information.
These were supposed to be the most discerning, sophisticated journalists in the country writing this stuff, and they were totally bamboozled.
And sure enough, in the newspapers, if you looked very hard inside in the next few days in the coverage, you could find really serious questions that were raised about this, but they were very much pushed aside.
This gets us right to the heart of the debate that's going on now in our craft. We lean heavily in reporting on what they say.
That's right.
We want no wider war. I'm not a crook. Mushroom cloud, weapons of mass destruction. We really give heavy weight to what public officials say.
Well, that's true, and we need to address that. In the end, it was, look, the president himself says these things are so. He stands before the Congress with the question of war and peace hanging in the balance and says these things. And there was a feeling, not just with myself, given all that, who am I to say, you know what, I think it's all a Machiavellian scheme to take us into Iraq.
Big news today in the cable world, Ellen. Phil Donahue, canceled by that other network.
22 days before the invasion, your show was canceled.
It should be said that we did fairly well in the ratings. We did not burn the town down. Nobody on MSNBC did. But we were certainly as good as anybody else on the network. And often, we led the network.
In dumping Donahue, NBC cited ratings. But a blogger got his hands on an internal memo, and the press picked it up.
Yeah, that memo said, Donahue presents a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. At the same time, our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. Did you know about that memo at the time?
No. I didn't know about that till I read about it in the New York Times.
What did you think? What does that say to you? That dissent is unpatriotic?
Well, not only unpatriotic, but it's not good for business.
Tonight, the case for war.
Showdown Iraq with Wolf Blitzer.
I think these executives were terrified of being called soft on terrorism. They absolutely knew that the winds were blowing at hurricane force politically and socially in the United States. And rather than stand up for journalism, they just blew with the wind. And Dan Rather and others who say, yeah, you know, I was carried away back then. Well, sure, that's when it matters. When it matters most is when you can make a difference as a journalist.
Fear is in every newsroom in the country. And fear of what? Well, it's the fear, it's a combination of, if you don't go along to get along, you're going to get the reputation of being a troublemaker. There's also the fear that, you know, particularly in networks, they become huge international conglomerates. They have big needs, legislative needs, regulatory needs in Washington. Nobody has to send you a memo to tell you that that's the case. You know. And that puts a seed in your mind of, well, if you stick your neck out, if you take the risk of going against the grain with your reporting, is anybody going to back you up?
The media just continued on this path of reporting, well, the Bush administration alleges that there are WMD and never really stopped and said it doesn't look like there are. There's no evidence. That should have been the second sentence in any story about the allegations of WMD. The second sentence should have been, but they did not present any evidence to back this up.
You know, we're sending young men and women, and nowadays not so young men and women, to risk their lives, and everyone wants to be behind them, and everyone should be behind them. The question for us in journalism is, are we really behind them when we fail to do our jobs? Is that really the kind of support that they deserve, or are we really in the long run serving them better by asking these hard questions about what we've asked them to do?
Good morning. Shock and awe.
Operation Iraqi Freedom. Reports of secret surrender talks as U.S. bombs hit Baghdad.
This CBS News special report is part of our continuing coverage of America at War.
4 years after shock and awe, the press has yet to come to terms with its role in enabling the Bush administration to go to war on false pretenses. Peter Beinart is almost alone in admitting he was mistaken.
Where I think I was tragically wrong was not to see in February, March 2003, after we got the inspectors back in on the ground, and we began to learn much more about what had been going on in Iraq than we had known in 2002 when we had no one on the ground, that assumption was being proven wrong.
You say tragically wrong.
Because I think the war has been a tragic disaster. I mean, the Americans killed, the Iraqis killed. It's true, life under Saddam was hell. But can one really say that life for Iraqis is better today?
We wanted to talk to some others in the media about their role in the run-up to the war. Judith Miller, who left The Times after becoming embroiled in a White House leak scandal, declined our request on legal grounds. The Times liberal hawk Thomas Friedman also said no. So did Bill Safire, who had predicted Iraq would now be leading the Arab world to democracy. President Bush recently awarded him the Medal of Freedom. The Washington Post Charles Krauthammer also turned us down. So did Roger Ailes, the man in charge of Fox News. He declined because, an assistant told us, he's writing a book on how Fox has changed the face of American broadcasting and doesn't want to scoop himself. William Crystal led the march to Baghdad behind a battery of Washington microphones. He has not responded to any of our requests for an interview, but he still shows up on TV as an expert, most often on Fox News.
And he's got to begin to show progress in 3, 4, 5 months once the U.S. troops get in.
Being a pro-war pundit means never having to say you're sorry.
I mean, these were people who were laying out the blueprint for the war about how it was going to unfold, and it turns out couldn't have been more wrong. Every which way.
You have a president.
And it's astonishing to see them still on TV, invited on as experts in the region.
It's true. So many of the advocates and apologists for the war are still flourishing in the media. Bill Kristol and Peter Beinart, for example, are now regular contributors to Time magazine, which has been laying off dozens of reporters. And remember this brilliant line?
We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. That could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
The man who came up with it was Michael Gerson, President Bush's top speechwriter. He has left the White House and been hired by the Washington Post as a columnist. The number of American troops killed in Iraq now exceeds the number of victims on 9/11. We have been fighting there longer than it took us to defeat the Nazis in World War II. The cost of the war are reckoned at $1 trillion and counting. The number of Iraqis killed, over 35,000 last year alone, is hard to pin down. The country is in chaos. That's our report. You can go to our website at pbs.org for an interactive media timeline tracking the coverage leading up to the invasion. Remember, we'll be back every Friday night on most stations with interviews and analysis, beginning this week with Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. Meantime, you're the public in public television, and your support of this local station assures our independence. I'm Bill Moyers.